Genesis 1 Continued, the second talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on February 27, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week I looked at Genesis chapter 1, the account of creation. This week my plan is to make a few comments about Genesis 1 to finish this up and then to throw it open for questions. There were several people that had their hands up at the end of time last week, and hopefully they're here and remember what their questions were. What I argued last week is that in Genesis chapter 1, God has a very specific purpose for why he has recorded this account the way that he has had it recorded. That his purpose was not to tell us how the universe was created, even though our curiosity would like to know all of the details. Clearly, all of the details are not there. It is a very sparse account. It only has a few details in it. It is not the kind of account that would enable us, if we wanted to create a universe, to go out and do it ourselves. But it has a very specific purpose, and that purpose is to provide us some basic information that is necessary for us to go ahead and make sense of the rest of Genesis and indeed the rest of the Bible and indeed all of human history. And that is, give us basic information about who is this being that created the universe, and why did he create this universe, and what role does man have to play in this? It does not give us complete answers even to those questions, but it does lay the groundwork. It does give us a few of the initial assumptions and understandings. So, given that understanding then, that's my assumption, is that that's what the author is trying to accomplish in Genesis 1. What is the structure of Genesis 1? What does he say? What's the basic outline of what he's saying? He asserts that God created everything in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But the rest of the account then goes on to talk about how God started this process whereby he began with chaos and darkness and transformed it into a place that is habitable and suitable for man, and then he places man in that environment. And he accomplishes this task in 6 days, and it describes it as being 8 different tasks. In the 6 days, starting the first day, he creates light. In the second day, he separates the skies from the seas, the waters from the waters. And on the third day, he creates the dry land. On the third day, he undertakes a separate task as well, and that is to furnish the dry land with vegetation. So in those first 3 days, it's movement from, with respect to man, distant to near. Starting in creating light, and I assume that that would relate to what we would call space, and then the seas and the skies, and then dry land. He starts back in the fourth day, starting distant and coming to near, and he populates each of those domains that he has created. On the fourth day, he creates the stars and the sun and the moon. On the fifth day, he creates the birds and the fish. And on the sixth day, he creates the animals in the first half of the day. Then in the afternoon, he makes man. So those are the six, and again, it's moving from far to near. The thing that is most pronounced here is this whole account is very anthropocentric. That is, it focuses on man. Man is the star in this creation account. The domains are created from distant to near with respect to man, and then they are populated from distant to near with respect to man, with man being the last act of creation. The other thing is, there is movement from chaos to order. There is, when things begin, when I'm referring to as the earth formation process, when that begins, it's described as being dark, and there's darkness. Everything was formless and void, and there was darkness on the face of the waters. So things are chaotic, unorganized. There is no definition, no distinction. It's just this dark soup that can't be made sense of. But through the process of creation, God slowly brings order to this mess and brings clarity. And by the end, it has the world that we know, and a world in which the sea is confined to a certain area, and darkness and light are separated out and distinct things. So it moves from far to near with respect to man, it moves from chaos to order, and man then is created as the pinnacle of that creative activity. Okay. Now, I want to look at John chapter 1, because it seems to me that the prologue to the Gospel of John is encouraging us to think back to the creation account. There are a couple of references here in the prologue that really seem to me they are calculated to make us think back to the creation account and are supposed to inform our understanding of this prologue. Now, I'm going to read this, but before I get into this, I have long wondered at why it starts out, "In the beginning was the Word." Why the Word? And I know that it is standard to take that word to mean the second person of the Trinity, that's referring to Jesus. But that's never been very satisfying to me, because why Word? Why did he choose the term Word to refer to that? So I began to think back to the Genesis account, and where does Word come in? It says, "In the beginning was the Word." Well, isn't that encouraging us to go back to the beginning? And what happens in the beginning? Isn't that the Genesis 1 account? And in the Genesis 1 account, we do have reference to, there is, in a sense, a word that plays a role, and that is, God said, "Let there be." With every task, it begins with "God said, let there be." So there is, in a sense, a word at the beginning. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking, maybe that's what John has in mind here. that John is referring to this word that was spoken by God in his creative activity. If you think about it, it's kind of interesting that God created things by word. He could have created things, he snapped his finger and it was. And there are any number of ways that it could have happened, but he chose to do it by speaking things into existence. And if he is speaking things into existence, if you think about speech, speech is the means by which we take ideas and put them into a form that can be understood by others. Mental telepathy does not work, at least not for me. That the only way that we have of getting ideas from my head into someone else's head is through language, through speech. So, could it be that the reason God spoke things into existence was to encourage us to liken words to things? That as words are to us, that is an expression of our thoughts, creation is to God, that is an expression of his thought. In other words, then creation would be a form of communication. So I began to think, well, maybe that's what's happening in John 1. And that where he's talking, when he uses the term word, what he's talking about is that communication that God has made in the form of creation. Yeah, I could take this further. I have developed this idea further. The only problem is I spent all week trying to figure out how it would fit in with John 1, and I can't make it fit. There are two or three places where I just can't make this understanding, this notion that I'm investing into the term word, I can't make it fit into this passage. In any case, though, let me read through this prologue because I think it is indeed hearkening back to the Genesis account. And before I read it, let me point out that where it says he, for instance, in verse 2, he was in the beginning with God, that is just a pronoun that refers back to word. So it could be translated it. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There came a man sent from God whose name was John. He came for a witness that he might bear witness of the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came that he might bear witness of the light. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came into his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me.' For of his fullness we have all received, and grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. No man has seen the Father at any time. the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. Now, there are a couple of reasons that I think that this clearly refers back to Genesis 1. One is it talks about in the beginning was the Word, which I think is encouraging us to think back. And then we have these references to the light being the first thing that was created. Just autobiographical, for what it's worth. There are times when I'll find something in the Bible that something that I don't quite understand that I'd really like to understand. And I figure, well, I'll just pour myself into this, and it's just enough time spent, enough time logged, and I'll solve this puzzle. But my experience is that more likely than not, I will spend a lot of time and I will come out with my hunch disproved and more confused than I was when I went into it. I don't say that to discourage you from such attempts, but that's my reality, and I would expect that that's true of other people as well. There is much in the Bible that I find extremely mysterious. And I have a very difficult time getting all of the pieces to fall in right so it really makes sense and everything fits and adds up the way it ought to. But God's a mysterious God. And he wrote the Bible cryptically. That's just the way it is. It's a mysterious book. And people have puzzled over it for centuries now. That doesn't mean that it's unprofitable, because there is much in Scripture that is clear. And in fact, the most important things in Scripture, I think, are the clearest. But there is much that remains mysterious. And my experience has been that over time, God will sometimes bring along the right associations that click things in, and all of a sudden the passage that was long time mysterious, all the pieces fall together. As I was investigating this and trying to figure out what was happening with Word, what became clear is that after the account in creation, whenever the Old Testament refers back to the creation account and refers to the fact that God spoke things into existence, the emphasis is not on the fact that creation is God's communication to us, but rather that God has enormous power and authority. If he can just say it, and it is, then he is extremely powerful. In fact, he is all-powerful. So consistently, as I look through the Old Testament for references to God speaking things into existence, it's with reference to God's power, that he is so powerful that he can do anything. And in fact, in most contexts, he is so powerful that he can even save you no matter what your circumstances. So it's that power and authority, and therefore his ability to pull us out of whatever quagmire we're in, that seems to be the reference. I still have not put all the pieces together in John 1, but my next guess then would be that that's the kind of association that's being made, that the word here is with respect to God's power and authority. Okay, the other image that comes up here is this image of light. And that is an image that is used in a number of times, a significant number of times, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. It is interesting that he created light on the first day. And I pointed out that I think at least part of the significance there is that God is telling us by that fact that he is the God who wants to reveal, he wants to illuminate. The first thing he did in this chaotic and dark environment was to make things visible. I mean, you can just imagine a beam of light shining through the darkness. I mean, like at the coast watching a lighthouse and the beam shining out. I mean, that's an incredible image of dispelling that darkness and making things visible that otherwise you could not see, even things that are obvious. The big and the obvious things are not discernible in darkness. It's only when there's lightness that they can be seen. That image of light is used then throughout the Old Testament. We have in Isaiah in particular, it says, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. And there it was talking about the people of Israel and their darkness with respect to not understanding and appreciating who God is and being tempted then to turn to other gods for their salvation. That same verse then is quoted in Matthew 4. I'll turn to that. With respect to Jesus. Matthew 4, 15 and 16. Here's talking about Jesus beginning his ministry. Actually, I'll start. I'll start in verse 12. Now when he heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum, which is by the sea in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet, saying, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light, and to those who were sitting in the land and shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. From that time, Jesus began to preach and say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So this image of light shining in the darkness then becomes associated with the ministry of Jesus and his proclamations with respect to who God is and what God is doing in this world is likened to that beam of light that shines through the darkness. Now, this image of dark, of light, lightness comes up again, and Bob Blanchard pointed this out to me after last Sunday. In Revelation 21, verse 1, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And then I'll skip down to verse 23. And the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. And the nations shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it. And in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gates shall never be closed, and they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. And nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And then also in the next chapter, let's see, verse 5. And there shall no longer be any night. And they shall not have need of the light of the lamp, nor of the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever. This is particularly interesting because we have a situation in which, again, there is light, but nothing, no luminous body. But the light apparently is purely from the glory of God. And we not only have no darkness, but we have no sea. So in both instances, the imagery is referring us back to the time before the creative activity had begun, the time when there was just chaos and darkness. In the new heavens and the new earth, there will not be the chaos, there will not be the darkness, and there will not be the sea. But all of those will be banished. Curious to be in a place where there is no darkness. That is, there's not even a shadow. There's not even dark corners. But rather, everything is illumined. And I suspect that it may be literally the case that there will be no darkness and that everything will be illumined by the glory of God physically. But more significantly is the spiritual parallel of that, and that is everything will be only light as opposed to darkness. So we have the beginning of before God begins to form the earth and make it suitable for man, we have chaos and darkness. But when God comes in and begins creating, he separates the light and the darkness. So they coexist, but they're separated. And that's the way the reality that we see is. There is both light and darkness. But then in the new heavens and the new earth, there is only light. The darkness is done away with forever. Let's look at the last day of creation because it ties in here. So Genesis chapter 2, verse 1. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. And by the seventh day God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. The description of this day is distinctly different from the description of any other day. Every other day begins with, and God said, then God said, and then it progresses through, and at the end we have, and there was evening and morning, day, whatever. All of the pattern that's been established in the first 6 days is violated in the seventh day. The seventh day is a completely different description, very little that is similar to the others. Here God has finished his creative activity and he is resting. Well, clearly God didn't need to rest. It is not the case that God was tired. So the resting must be for us. The resting must be an image that is for our benefit rather than actual resting that was necessary for his well-being. And there are several things that are worthy of note here with respect to the seventh day. The first is that it's something that is done after work. God has worked for 6 days, and then he rests. Secondly, the first 6 days are a finite period. Each of the 6 days have an evening and morning of that day. The seventh day is different in that it has no evening and no morning. So the period of time in which work is done is finite. The period of the resting, there's no indication that it is finite. Thirdly, the rest is different in that this day is by God sanctified and set apart. It is completely different from the days of the work. And fourthly, it's the thing that gives meaning to the days of work. The days of work are what make sense of the rest. It is the goal or the reward at the end of that work. So apparently God is intending this to be some kind of image which we can draw upon and we can use to make sense of other things that God is doing. The rest was not for God's sake. It had to have been for our sake. And there are a number of ways that this image could be applicable to us as believers. But one way is in our own personal lives, and I think we are encouraged elsewhere in Scripture to see it in this respect, that we all are at some time in this state of chaos and darkness that begins the creative activity that God describes. In other words, we all begin in a state in which we do not understand, we do not see what's really out there. We are in a state of darkness. We have no understanding of the way that reality really is, why we're here, what gives purpose and meaning to life. And I think we can all probably identify with the activity of God when he shines his light into our lives and dispels some of that darkness. I mean, apart from God's activity, apart from God's revelation and illumination, we would all be stuck all life long in that darkness. If you look around at people around us, you see how many people are really confused. Many of them would even admit to it in certain times of their life, their confusion with respect to what life is all about. Others may not admit to it, but their lives betray it. That as they live their lives, they leave a swath of destruction in their path. And it's clear that they don't have a clue what they're doing. Much of their activity is self-destructive. If they had any understanding at all, they would at least avoid self-destruction. But apart from God, how do you make sense of things? Where do you get that understanding that allows you to figure out what's going on? And I think we all can identify with that period in our life. It may not be a moment. It may be an extended period of time, but a time when God shined his light into our lives and dispelled some of that darkness. And things began to make a certain amount of sense. It wasn't all light, and it still is not all light. there is still a mixture of understanding and confusion in all of us. We would all dearly like it to be just understanding. But we're still, as we go through life, leaving at least a little swath of destruction behind us and chaos. That because of the sin that we are not aware of, or sometimes it's a sin we're aware of, but we just can't seem to find our to fight free from. So in this life, then, it is work. This is a period of time when it is partially light and partially dark. But the time will come when all will be light and there will be no more work. The time is coming, and it can't come soon enough, but the time is coming when this work will end. And all will be light. We will understand who we are, who God is, why we exist, and we will understand the nature of righteousness and what obedience entails. So the seventh day then becomes that reminder that this is not the end. This is not all there is in reality. And I think that that's the importance of the commandment and the Ten Commandments of keeping the Sabbath. It is a weekly reminder that this is the time of work. This is the time that is temporary. This is the time when things, we ought not invest ourselves in this time, because the real time is yet to come. What history is pointing to is yet to come. Okay. Now I want to talk just a little bit now about why we do exist. Why is it that man, why did God create man? It is curious and very godlike that he doesn't make it explicit. My children got a computer game for Christmas called Myst, and I asked them what is the purpose of the game, and they said, we don't know yet. What's the goal? What are you trying to accomplish? They said, we don't know yet. That's part of the game. Well, that's very lifelike. That to a certain extent we know what our purpose is, but in another sense, that's a process that we are learning throughout all of our days. But it is hinted at in Genesis 1. It says that God created man in his image and likeness. It would make sense then that at least part of our purpose is to exhibit that image and that likeness. And what I argued last week is that the thing that we are to image, the thing that we are supposed to reflect, and the thing that's in mind in this account is God's moral character. It's not that we have the same color eyes. It's not that we have the same dimples. But rather, it's the thing that we are imaging and like God, the respect in which we are like God, is that we were made to be moral beings. And in order to be moral beings, God had to equip us with certain kinds of traits, including rationality, judgment, conscience, creativity even. There are a variety of, a certain amount of power. There are a number of, a will. a number of attributes that we had to have in order to be good moral creatures. We couldn't be moral creatures without them. So in order to reflect the moral character of God, we had to be the kinds of creatures that he made us to be. But our purpose is to reflect God's moral character. And I argued for that last time. The reason I think this is an interesting question is because I have noticed recently that, and I would like to keep record of this, how many of the great thinkers of the past have urged us to be like God? It's a whole slew of them. And the ones that immediately come to mind, Thomas Hobbes. Rousseau mentions it. I think it comes up in Frankenstein, if I'm not mistaken. Goethe and Faust. All of them say that we encourage us as human beings, we need to be like God. The only thing is, they are thinking in terms of God, a different attribute of God that we should imitate. They are thinking in terms of power. We should be like God in terms of power. Or we should be like God in terms of creativity. Or we should be like God in terms of autonomy. In making our own decisions with respect to what is right and what is wrong. In each of those instances, they are saying we should be like God, but they're looking at a different aspect of God that we are to imitate. I think that's curious because I suspect that's an indication that the desire to be like God is built into us. We all sense that there is something special about us as creatures, that we have a potential that is unrealized. And it is curious that in chapter 3 of Genesis, that's the very weakness that is played into by the serpent. The serpent says, "You shall be like God." It is both a weakness and a strength. It's a desire that's built into us by God to be like him. The only thing is it's easily diverted into imitating God in respects that we were not made to imitate him. And away from the way in which we are designed to be like him. That is, to reflect his moral character. If you look at things from that perspective, Jesus is a curious character. Jesus, who is God in flesh, he comes to earth. That's not what anyone would have expected God to look like. We are predisposed to be attracted to the power and the authority of God and expect to see Jesus come as a being who goes around flaunting that power and authority. He wasn't without that power and authority, but what made him distinctive was his moral character, and therefore hard to recognize to people like us. It is curious that he got the biggest crowds when he did use his power. That was attractive to people. But this raises the question of whether God created mankind to reflect his character, or did he make the individual man to reflect his character. In other words, What is the pinnacle of creation? Is it the individual person, or is it mankind in general? And this too has become was raised as a question in my mind, and looking at, in particular, at Thomas Hobbes, but also Dante has a writing that raises this issue. The question is, which is supposed to serve the other? Does man serve mankind, or does mankind serve man? Now, put in those terms, that's hard to understand. I came up with an analogy, which is a very unfortunate analogy, but I couldn't come up with a better one. So I'll use it anyway, but keep in mind it's an unfortunate one for reasons that will become apparent. Think of a soccer team, and a soccer league. How do you know when someone is a good soccer player? Is it skill? Is the good soccer player the one with the most skill? The answer to that question is no. The good soccer player is the one who most contributes to the team. That the soccer player uses the skills for the service of the team. The purpose of the player serves the team. Does the purpose of the team serve the league? There I would say no. The league exists in order for the team to display its ability. So both the player serves the team and the league serves the team. The league is just a showplace for the team. So the player is serving the team and the league is serving the team. The team is the ultimate entity in that series. Does that make sense? I lose people. Okay, now I'm going to switch to professional wrestling. We've got a professional wrestler, we've got a tag team, and we've got the World Wrestling Federation or whatever. What makes a good wrestler? Is it the wrestler that contributes most to the team? I don't think so. A good wrestler is one that attracts the most fans. It doesn't matter whether the team wins or loses. So in that case, the team serves the wrestler. And the league serves the team. So the entity there that we're really concerned with is the wrestler, as opposed to the soccer team, where it's the team. Which is it with respect to man and mankind? Are we more like the soccer player, or are we more like the wrestler? I'm sorry to say it, but we're more like the wrestler. Because mankind's purpose is to serve the individual rather than the other way around. That becomes really significant when you're thinking about, for instance, why government exists. Both Hobbes and Dante are saying that the purpose of government is to allow man to be like God. But what they mean is it to allow mankind to be like God. In other words, it's only when you have the right form of government that you can have people working together and we can have anything that approximates God-likeness with respect to power and creativity. The individual, what happens in that situation? Well, the individual is neither here nor there. The individual can kind of fall by the wayside because what we're concentrating on is mankind. And the individual has to do what is best for the whole, for the collective. So it's an important distinction here that at the end of creation, God made Adam. In the sixth day, God made Adam. I think that's significant. He didn't make a whole bunch of people. He made a man. It is true, he also makes Eve and he makes possible mankind. But the pinnacle of creation is the individual rather than the collective. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that on Judgment Day, mankind is not going to stand before God and say, "How do we do?" But rather, each individual is going to stand naked before God and make an accounting for his actions, make an accounting for his life. That's significant, I think, in not just for those who are theorizing with respect to government, but with respect to any collective, with any assembly of people, that what we're interested in is serving the individual, that is, encouraging each and every person to reflect God's moral character. And the collective, it exists for that purpose, for aiding the individual. It's a forum in which we can learn righteousness and live it out. Okay. That's all that I had, that I wanted to add to the discussion of Genesis 1. If you have any questions or comments on what I said today or last Sunday, please.
I had a question left from last week.
Yes.
So I wanted to say I really appreciate your teaching last week and this week. I'm getting a lot out of that. And I've kind of written it down so I'd remember. Thank you. Anyway, I don't know if, after hearing you, I don't know if it's profitable or worthwhile, but what I thought about when you talked about how the first verse of the Bible is foundational in saying that God created everything, then we go on with the second verse saying that, you know, the earth was there, and that's about all we get to know, is that from then on, God, it explains the rest of what you've been saying. In talking to people, I've heard a lot, and maybe this is just a thing in our time that's going on, about how Genesis, and I think referring to the first few chapters of Genesis, how important and foundational it is for our belief in God, and how the theory of evolution was directly against that, and what's being taught in schools and things goes against, you know, that God did it, God created. And then there are people who, well, like I've been talking to someone who, from Mormonism, from that background, the belief there is that matter is eternal, but God didn't create matter. He just rearranged it. And it's kind of vague for them how that happened with matter, but that's their belief. And so, you know, for me, it's like, with what I've learned so far and everything, it's like, well, okay, we have this strong stuff to fight against because we have it clearly here and the first part of Genesis and everything, but then it's not really all that clear from what you're saying. And I don't know how to deal with that.
Well, it's unfortunate that we live in a time when this issue has become so polemicized that it's really hard to read Genesis 1 without having in the back of our mind the creation-evolution debate. And what we'd really like is for Genesis 1 to soundly refute evolution. But I'm really convinced that, and I guess I think it really makes sense that it's unlikely that that's what God intended here in Genesis 1. And that Genesis 1 is not really telling us the steps and the mechanics by which God accomplished what he accomplished. Rather, that it's portraying the account in such a way that we can understand where we fit into it. That not just physically, but what is our significance here? What is our importance here? How do we relate to the rest of creation? That's the point, rather than how did all of this stuff, how did God pull this stuff off? I find myself in a situation where when I look at Genesis 1, I don't really see a refutation of evolution. It seems to me that evolution could account for much of what it describes here. The only place where I have a real problem is the Bible, it seems to me, clearly teaches that man is a distinct creation. That we could not have had a situation in which we have a man whose parents were monkeys. That there has to be a clean break. There's a real distinction between man and the rest of the animals. But that's the only place here that I have a real problem with evolution. However, having said that, I think evolution is scientifically silly. My concern with evolution is I don't think it matches up with the facts. It just does. It's so. I would have to see for instance, a cow being born to horses, that you can make that kind of transformation. I'd have to see that happen before I would be convinced, or see the, even if they fill in the blanks in the bones, there would be other kinds of evidence like that I would have to see before I would be compelled by the theory of evolution. But I don't see this account in Genesis as refuting evolution. But the reason it's become so important to us as Christians is evolution has become the way by which people can explain away God. And that's what's really critical, is that even if evolution is the way by which we came, the animal life that we see around us and the plant life came to be, it had to have been directed by God. It had to have been the way by which he did what he did. That is absolutely mandatory from the Genesis 1 account, that God was the creator who created this stuff and was orchestrating and supervising however indeed it did happen.
Seems to me there are many aspects of being human that we do in fact share with animals. There are, and those are quantifiable. Intellect, you know, animals solve some problems and come up with some things. Right. And communication, they have a certain rudimentary language and whatnot. Right. And even among human beings, those qualities are quantifiable. You know, some people are geniuses, some people are not geniuses. Some people are very creative, some people just take it as it comes. But when it comes to the moral aspect, that's not quantifiable. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about this all week. When we are in glory, when we are truly redeemed and made beautiful, we'll still have, you know, tall and short people and geniuses and, you know, not so geniuses and people who are eloquent and people who are simple in their language, but we will all be morally perfect. And that's non-quantifiable. And in a sense, that's the only way we are actually like God in glory. I mean, is that make sense?
Mm-hmm. That makes good sense.
Because because I see us pursuing and celebrating many, many aspects of human nature which reflect God's nature. Power. I mean, there have been good kings and queens and rulers. There's been tyrannical despots, and there's been incompetent rulership. There have been artists who can teach you the truth in a three-dimensional object. And we pursue those so much. And yet in the end, the only way we'll be able, this is my theory, the only way I'll be able to stand up before the universe and be proud of myself is say, God made me just like him in this area. I'm morally perfect. So in the image, being in the image and nature of God, and the thing that set me off on this was the debate we had about being scum. You know, we're pond scum, but God loves us anyway. In a sense, all the things we talk about being magnificent, you know, we have intellect, we have language, we have law, we have government, we have art, you know, we have this, blah, 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 on and on. Who cares? Because that's not the currency God is asking for. In a sense, it's the same thing he gave to animals at certain levels. So why do we drop back and tell ourselves that we're magnificent with those things when it's this other thing which we have nothing of that we're going to be judged on? And is it fair to use that to salvage some self-esteem? Because I don't think it is, but right. We do.
Right.
That's kind of my comment, my question.
Right. And I think that's absolutely right. But the thing that we really seek after is the power and the achievement and that sort of thing, which ultimately we recognize that when it comes to attaining godness with respect to those things, we fall woefully short. So what we have to do is get more people, cooperate. If we can just all work on it, we can get closer. Hobbes calls it the mortal God. That if we can all get together and cooperate in one unit, we can become a mortal God. That is the closest thing that we can come to being godlike. That's the way he's seeing it. And it's perverse, ultimately.
So those things which I would accuse someone of using to rescue their self-esteem actually may in fact be magnificent. It's not that they're not ungodlike.
Right.
Because intellect is godlike.
Right.
Power is godlike. Creativity is godlike. It's just that we're not very good at it.
Right. We weren't made to be godlike in that respect. I mean, not to the magnitude that he
right.
is.
I agree with everything you said, Logan. The only thing I'm nervous about is something that you didn't make explicit. So I don't know if you were talking about our being pond scum, but God loves us anyway, and our attempt to rescue our self-esteem. I agree with that in the sense that, you know, we do try to pat ourselves on the back. Okay, I may be unkind to the people around me, but boy, watch me do math, or watch me program my computer, or don't I have great eyes, or I'm Bill Gates and I've got a multi-million-dollar company. All these kind of things that we use to try to salvage our self-esteem. And I agree that's a big mistake, because the thing that's most significant about me is corrupt. And when it comes down to it, it's not just the animals that we have a continuum on. It's what makes the fact that we share some things with animals encourages us to the fact that we excel, for the most part, in the things that we compare ourselves with animals, doesn't encourages us to think along the lines of, I'm more significant than a monkey, because even though a monkey, Snowball, the gorilla, can manipulate symbols, I'm much better at that than mm-hmm. she or he is. But if you think in terms, if you're going to have some kind of a hierarchy based on these things, some animals are better at certain things than we are. A jaguar is much faster. A gorilla is much stronger. Some things are more powerful than we are. An atom bomb can do much more damage than I can ever do by myself. So that, realizing that there are some things, non-human things, that actually are superior to us in certain kinds of power will also make us reluctant to use those things as a basis for establishing our self-esteem. But so saying that the most significant thing about me is my morality, my moral, my ability, my being a moral being, and then that the fact that that's the case really is bad news when I realize what kind of a moral being I am. And so that would suggest to us, self-esteem is, I'm not going to find it in power. That obviously doesn't make a lot of sense, but the place where I should find it, I've really got a problem, because I'm not good. That could lead us down the road of saying, I am pond scum. Well, the trouble with saying that I'm pond scum is it makes God an idiot for trying to save pond scum. There is some, I think, real basis in recognizing human worth, despite the fact that power isn't going to do it. That's a logical problem with that. And where we should be able the real essence of human worth, we have a right intuition that it's our more moral, the fact that we are moral beings. If we say, I'm scum, I'm garbage, I'm worthless, I'm useless, whatever, that's good to recognize, but at the same time, if we don't recognize some source of worth, it makes God an idiot for doing what he did. There is something about us that makes us worthwhile appropriate objects of his love. I'm not sure I can articulate it exactly. Maybe it's just the fact that we are beings with moral capacity. It's corrupted capacity, yes, but moral capacity in itself, corrupted or otherwise, is a important, significant thing. It makes us appropriate objects of God's love. God is not stupid to save us, because we aren't pond scum. I'd like your reaction to that, and I'd also just to segue with your question of what is the purpose of man, why were we created, I wanted to get your take on what you think of this. Yes, I agree with you. I think that we were created to reflect God's image, his moral image, but it occurred to me, and I can't prove this, it's just an intuition, but Adam, before God creates Eve, he creates the animals and shows them to Adam and says, please name them. And it's in the process of doing that that Adam realizes there's nobody here like me. And everybody who ever teaches about this says the reason God did this was to make Adam aware of his need and then to satisfy that need. Is it possible that one of the reasons why we were created was because God looked around wherever he is before he created the universe and said, there's nobody here like me. A loving being needs an object, a fitting object to love. And so he created us to be a fitting object for that love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also can't prove it, but I think your intuition is right, that not only is he a loving God, if you think about the attributes of God that become so remarkable as we read through Scripture, it's not just his love, but his grace, his mercy, his patience. There are other attributes that are really significant. And in order for those attributes to be displayed, he had to have an object with respect to which to display those things. And if you think about it, the most fitting object with which to display those things is a disobedient object. We're really well suited to bring out those characteristics that make God so remarkable. And yet, characteristics that would have been invisible had it not been for us. So I think that's absolutely right. That God wanted to... The universe is this stage that God wanted to create in order to have both an audience and a play in which he could make known the kind of being that he is.
I'm still lost a bit. Logan, I agree with you. We're lacking in the moral aspect. But if self-esteem arises out of being moral beings, being morally like God, there is basically no basis for self-esteem other than hope. Okay, so is self-esteem based in hope? And if it's not, what is it based in? Would you like me to throw this to you? Make good fishing bait.
See, my problem is not. you come all the way over here, and then I come. See, I have no problem with not being able to salvage some sort of self-esteem. I think my closest analogy to God's value of us is that of a collector. If you've ever met someone who has an obsession for collecting something you find absolutely worthless, you understand it. I know someone who collects frogs. And I just, on the web last night, I found an entire society out there that collects telegraph keys. Okay? This is the Telegrapher Historical Society. And they collect telegraph keys. And they value, this one company only made 200 of this one kind of telegraph key back in the 1920s, and they'll kill for one of these things. Now, their inherent worth is minimal, unless you happen to be a telegrapher and you're trying to get a message out. But they say, I want that thing. There's something I see in that thing that I value, and it makes me feel a certain way to have this thing. If I pretend to be God and create this race of really ugly, horrible, terrible beings. I can also say these really ugly, horrible, terrible beings have intellect and judgment. They understand time, history. They have a sense of future. They have a retarded sense of love. I mean, the Nazis loved their children, right? And that's not a completely ugly thing. The fact that they didn't love the Jews and their children is an ugly thing. So I could say, yeah, this Nazi's a pond scum. He is before the universe a perfect example of what not to be, just like me. If God ever wanted to hold someone up and say, now, you know what I really hate? Look at Logan. Okay, I see moral cowardice. I see impatience. I see selfishness. I see someone who doesn't think about the future, who doesn't learn from his past. But you know what else? Logan has intellect, and he makes decisions, and he has some sense of the future, and he learns some things from his past. I have endowed him with qualities that are like mine. And I have an expectation on him, which I don't put on any other creature I made. Those qualities and that expectation puts him in a whole nother place. He's something I want in my collection. I made him for my collection. Now the rest of the universe, like the angels who long to look into this thing, they're sitting there going, this pinhead? I mean, look what he does. Look what goes on in his heart. He's evil. And God says, I know that. See, he's not worth anything to you. You didn't make him. I made him. And in the end, I will make him like me. He will be morally perfect. His intellect may not increase. His judgment will, his morality will rule over all those other faculties. Then he will be beautiful. Me here, as a human being, can't salvage any self-esteem from what I have and what I've got. All I can say is, but these things God gave me, God values. That makes me valuable. It's not because, and personally, to say God is stupid to rescue pond scum, I don't agree with either, because if he says it's valuable, then it's his pond scum, and it's suddenly attained value. If it's completely worthless, and God says, I want it in my collection, then it suddenly became worth something. But see, what does he need from us? Is he lonely?
That's where I get stuck.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to break us off. Because whoever's taking care of children is probably pulling their hair out right now. So we're done.